Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 7th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll speak to Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI. Now we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Let's start, Kristen, this week with the news on a new regional middle school for Dennis Yarmouth. There was a real sense of uncertainty, I think, going into this, and there seems to be a sense of uncertainty now coming out of the vote as well. You have a few articles about this week. Begin by talking a little bit about the vote itself. What was being voted on, and why was it contentious?
Sure. So as you mentioned, it's sort of uncertainty surrounding this. I think this is kind of an election that seems to have raised almost as many questions as it's answered. On Tuesday, there was a district-wide ballot vote across the two towns to approve a $117 million regional middle school for grades 4 through 7, and that passed by just 32 votes. But individually, the towns took opposing positions. Just over 60% of Dennis voters approved the school, and about 56% of Yarmouth voters rejected it. I spoke with Board of Selectmen Chair Norman Holcomb in Yarmouth, and he said that he feels Yarmouth voters are really sort of being forced into a corner on this project. The Yarmouth Board had come out along with the Yarmouth Finance Committee and actually the Dennis Finance Committee in advance of the vote and recommended voting against it. He said Yarmouth voters voted along with the recommendations that their town officials had made and that they're still being forced into this project. And he said he wants to explore all the choices that Yarmouth has in front of it at this stage, which in his mind, deregionalization came up as one thing that he wants to explore. Yarmouth also rejected a debt exclusion that would raise taxes during the term of the loan to fund the school. Yarmouth's share is about $48.7 million. And Dennis passed their debt exclusion, which would fund its share, which is just about $24.2 million. Holcomb said that he finds it hard to believe that the Massachusetts School Building Authority, which has said that they're going to reimburse the school for about $45.3 million, will stand by it and vote to approve it. They have a final vote on December 12th, knowing that Yarmouth voters actually didn't support it overall. I did, however, speak with school committee chair Jenny Landers, and she said that the day after the vote, school officials reached out to the authority, and they said that they do plan from Landers' understanding that they do plan to move forward and approve the school.
So there was a margin here. This was an incredibly close vote in the end between the two towns. The margin of difference is 32 votes.
Yes. And there were some people, you know, when I spoke to Landers immediately after the election, she said she would expect that people might be calling for a recount. It doesn't look like that's the case at this point. I did speak with both town clerks who said they'd gotten a few calls inquiring about the process, but because the ballot didn't include write-ins, the chance that even if a recount did go forward, that it would overturn the current outcome is really slim, and that people who have called to ask about the process really understand it. They said the tabulators are very accurate, and the only way that numbers could shift would be, I guess there were 5 blank ballots cast in Dennis. There were no blank ballots cast in Yarmouth, and those could potentially be considered to be intended as no votes, but even in that case, it wouldn't change the overall outcome of the election.
So there's a little bit to unpack here, too, because there's voter turnout, which is one of the questions about this, I think, that people have raised or pointed to anyway, saying this is kind of significant that,
yeah.
And also the hours that the polls were open were a little bit different than people expected.
Yes. So there's a state law, actually, that says in a district-wide election, polls need to be open for no fewer than 4 hours and no longer than 8 hours, and that they need to be uniform across the district. So that means that Dennis and Yarmouth had to have the same polling hours. It was decided, I think the school committee ultimately made the decision of what those hours were, and it was noon to 8 rather than starting earlier in the morning, as is usually the case in most elections. We did have a couple calls on election day pointing that out of voters, you know, who had gone to the polls and realized that they weren't open yet. And we're feeling a little frustrated. The towns did do their job in publicizing this the way they should according to state laws. It was also publicized on the town's websites and available in the newspaper. But these people said, well, they should have put out signs or something so that people who aren't maybe online so much or reading the newspapers would have known that these hours were a little different. But now sort of looking forward, the towns are wondering, you know, Yarmouth especially is trying to, it seems like, sort of find a way out of this possibly, or at least exploring legally what those options might be. Holcomb said he wants Yarmouth taxpayers to really understand the financial implications of moving forward, considering the regional agreement between the two towns. This is something that Yarmouth has been pushing to change for years. It was close to coming to an agreement with Dennis on some changes that would have sort of helped Yarmouth financially speaking. Yarmouth has really struggled to pay for its share of the budget in recent years as its enrollment continues to rise and Dennis's continues to drop. That's because the regional agreement assesses capital and operating costs based on the number of students that each town sends to DY. There was some initial, you know, back in March, I think, they came close to agreeing, and then each town sort of points to the other town as to why that agreement never happened. Holcomb said really that it's now up to the school committee to take that regional agreement and see if they can put something forward that would be palatable to both towns. He really wants Landers to kind of take the lead on that. I did speak with Landers, who said that she is planning to put some possible amendments in front of the committee and that they could, you know, potentially vote on that. It would still need to be approved by each town meeting and by the state. So a long way to go there.
So two things maybe to point out here. We started to talk about the vote itself, and there was only 18% turnout really across the district.
Is that right? So there was 18%. It was just over 18% in each town. Terry Bunce, who's the town clerk in Dennis, said that for a local election is really a pretty good turnout. But when you consider that this is, especially for Yarmouth, potentially one of the biggest capital projects they've ever seen to date. You know, you would think that maybe more people than 18% would want to get out and have a say in that. And so there was a caller I spoke with, the town clerk there, Philip Gaudet, who said he spoke with someone who had called in and said, wow, you know, I wish more people had gotten out to the polls and maybe that could have influenced the outcome a little bit.
I thought also this fact that Yarmouth, though they voted against this and didn't vote for a debt exclusion either, is still on the hook no matter what. Even if they wanted to go through deregionalization, they're legally bound to pay for their share of the school now.
That's right. If they go through the process of deregionalization, which would be very complicated, and I think when I spoke with officials the day after the election, a lot of them were still sort of deferring to their lawyers, to town council, about how that process would play out and if it was even a possibility now that they're bound into this agreement. But one thing that Town Administrator Daniel Knapik said was that Yarmouth is still going to be on the hook for any unpaid operating costs and owed debt once it deregionalizes, if that's even something that they can do. And that would include, now that this vote is passed, that would include the town's $4.8 million share of construction costs. So he said the town's on the hook for it. He doesn't know any other way around it. I think, you know, a lot of other officials were sort of looking to talk to their lawyers about what the next steps are going to be.
And just briefly, the opportunity for a recount actually expires. There's a date at which this passes.
Yes, it's next Friday, actually. And so if people, you know, did want to push for that, if that was something they wanted to do, they would need to go pick up those petition papers in the town clerk's offices. They would also need to explain what the reason for the recount would be and go out and get at least 10 signatures in each precinct where they're asking for a recount.
I want to bring in WCAI lead reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, who's joining us for a couple stories here. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Sarah, the future of the Cape Cod Canal bridges, the Bourne and the Sagamore, was the topic of discussion at a public meeting. It's the first of a number of meetings. You were there on Tuesday night. Tell us what this is about generally.
Sure. So the meeting was essentially just an introduction to the bridges and the fact that they need work done. The Army Corps is still working on a report about the futures of the bridges, but they did outline a few options they're considering, and they walked people through what those options would entail. They also said it was an opportunity for the public to voice their opinions on the alternatives. So that's about it.
Kristen, the town of Bourne has some specific concerns here.
Yeah, well, so Bourne, the people in Bourne said that, you know, this is a project that really does impact the regional quality of life, but that residents in Bourne are the most affected, and they're going to have to deal with it every day with construction. They have, you know, they're the ones who are really there that are going to be dealing with the impacts on a day-to-day basis.
Sarah, this was at Bourne High School. What was the mood in the room? What were folks saying?
Yeah, a number of people actually did complain that the meeting didn't seem to tell them anything they didn't already know. But the Army Corps has a process, so this meeting was kind of just a recap of a lot of conversations people have already been having kind of out in the public sphere. There are about 60 people or so. A number of people were pretty disgruntled, and a few voiced comment around options like building a third bridge that would run between the Sagamore and Bourne bridges, and also building a tunnel that could run under the canal, neither of which were options laid forth by the Corps.
What kinds of alternatives were the Corps talking about? Kristen, do you have a sense?
So they talked about either doing a major rehabilitation of each bridge as it currently exists and then maintaining those rehabbed bridges into the future, or possibly replacing one or both bridges with a new structure that would be built to the current authorization of 4 lanes. Right now, the lanes there are more narrow. It's that the bridge is considered functionally obsolete. It's structurally okay, but functionally obsolete means that the lanes aren't as built to the width that they should be, that they don't incorporate walkers and bikers and keep them at a safe distance from traffic. The other option would be to replace both bridges and have 2 lanes of travel each way, along with 2 auxiliary lanes that would be for acceleration and deceleration.
So the Army Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction over the bridges, but really they have to coordinate with the Massachusetts Department of Transportation because they're the ones who are in charge of the roads and the rotaries and all everything that connects to those bridges. Sarah, how does this wrap up? What happens next?
Sure. So this was just the first of 5 public meetings that are similar to this around the Cape. 2 more happened later this week, and the next meeting is scheduled to take place on the Vineyard. The Corps is putting together a formal study on the 2 bridges called the MRER is the acronym. But they're putting together a formal study on these 2 bridges and the work that they think needs to be done on them. The Corps says that data that they're collecting on the bridges and the analysis and the draft documents for this report should be ready by the summer of 2019.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. With us from WCAI, Sarah Meisestan. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Also with us in the studio is Sarah Meisestan from WCAI. On the phone with us right now from the Vineyard Gazette is Bill Evel. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Bill, water contamination has been identified out at the airport on Martha's Vineyard and in some nearby wells. This has to do with firefighting foams, which are used at airports getting into the groundwater. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it's a big issue that surfaced this week at the airport. And in fact, it's part of a nationwide issue that's now playing out on our shores. The problem that surfaced this week is, as you said, the chemicals used in the firefighting foam. Thankfully, there aren't many crashes at the airport, but of course, training needs to be done, usually about twice a year. But recently it was discovered that the main chemicals in the firefighting foam, called polyfluoroalkyl, or PFAS, has leached into the ground and contaminated several wells near the airport. Now, a safe reading in the wells would be 70 parts per trillion of PFAS, but wells around the airport registered 1,000 parts per trillion. These chemicals can adversely affect the kidneys, the liver, the immune system, and, of course, pregnancies. Now, earlier this week, the airport held a meeting with local abutters, and as you can imagine, it was quite heated. Airport Director Ann Richard said they first became aware of the issue late last year. As a result, they hired the firm Tetra Tech to begin testing the airport monitoring wells. More recently, they realized they needed to widen the scope, and they began testing some of the residents' private wells in the area. When they were found out to be contaminated, they've got the word out. As I said, this is a nationwide issue, and the use of these firefighting foams has long been scrutinized. They have to use really heavy-duty stuff to fight jet fuel fires, but it also comes with risks. In 2002, a new foam came into use that was supposed to be safer than the one previously used, but we know that's not the case now. Recently, the FFA did pass legislation allowing airports to use a foam that doesn't have the PFAS chemicals, so the airport is looking into alternatives. So what next? The testing is going to continue, plus the airport said they are creating a more effective cleanup strategy of the foam. They now are using a catch basin so it doesn't leach into the ground, and they're exploring these different types of foam they could use. But also at issue is the fact that the Vineyard is a sole source aquifer, meaning all of our drinking water is in one place, and that place happens to be right near the airport under the surrounding state forest. As of yet, the aquifer has not been tested, so we're following that story too.
Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thank you for updating us on that.
All right. I'll keep you posted. Thanks, Steve.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times and Sarah Mises-Tan of WCAI. Another potential enormous construction project for the region, this time offshore. It's the Vineyard Wind proposal for a wind farm south of Martha's Vineyard. A report from the federal government out this week marks a big step along the way. Sarah, tell us what this report was and why it's significant.
Sure. This is a draft of the federal government's environmental assessment of the area in the ocean that Vineyard Wind will be building their 800-megawatt offshore wind farm. Essentially, it's a marker of whether or not the federal agency, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, will give final approval on Vineyard Wind's construction plans. Next, there will be a period of public comment on the report that'll run through mid-January, and the agency will be taking concerns voiced from fishermen at these meetings back and incorporating that in their final report, which is due out in summer of 2019. Vineyard Wind is expected to still be on track to begin construction at the end of next year.
Kristen, it's a big, long report. Tell us some of the things that it details.
So, as you mentioned, it's long. The draft report is a 500-page analysis of the potential environmental, social, economic, historic, and cultural effects that could come from the construction, operation, maintenance, and eventually down the road, the decommissioning of the offshore wind energy facility, which will be located 14 miles southwest of Martha's Vineyard. Some of the things that the report talked about, actually, it laid out a grid of potential impacts, and those were negative and positive effects, and they were sort of described as negligible, minor, moderate, or major. The major negative effects from the report actually have to do with fishing, particularly in Lewis Bay in West Yarmouth, where the cable from the project was initially expected to make landfall. In the report, the Lewis Bay fishermen are described as vulnerable because disruption of the bay there by dredging or blocking access could actually put them out of business. The good news, though, for Lewis Bay fishermen is that although the final decision is still sort of up to be decided in April, Vineyard Wind has said that instead of laying the cable in Lewis Bay, it now intends to bring it onshore at Colville Beach in Barnstable, and that would then go to an underground cable along the streets to a substation, an electrical substation on Independence Drive.
In the larger picture for Vineyard Wind, Sarah, this doesn't appear to represent a roadblock in their path.
No, definitely not. So, I mean, I guess as Kristen already said, there were some moderate effects on the commercial fishing industry that were cited in the report. And they also cited that there might be an increase in vessel traffic in the area due to turbine construction. Vineyard Wind mentioned that they've really been trying to get out ahead of a lot of these concerns, though. The report, which was put together before the company had decided whether or not they would go through Colville's Beach or through Lewis Bay, the report does favor the Colville's Beach option as the better option, and it does mention that Lewis Bay is an area of concern, so Vineyard Wind was pretty happy to see that BOEM seems to agree with the decision that they've made. The company has also recently announced that their turbine manufacturer can manufacture larger, more powerful turbines, and so they predict that they will actually have to build less turbines in the area, which they hope can allay some of the fears that fishermen have voiced about navigating the area. Though, of course, no final word on that part yet.
WCAI's lead reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for joining us this
morning.
Thanks,
Steve.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Barnstable County has been dealing with contamination at its fire academy and its impacted drinking water. The Department of Environmental Protection wants more cleanup to happen there. This is related to what we were just hearing about on the Vineyard as well.
Yes. So the Department of Environmental Protection conducted an audit in October. I'm sorry, conducted an assessment in October of whether cleanup at the site, which is on South Flint Rock Road, just north of Barnstable Municipal Airport, is being implemented according to a plan that was submitted by the county to the DEP in 2016. The DEP also went and observed live fire training activities to evaluate how water use in the exercises disperses across the property. Now, the real issue here is the use of firefighting foams containing PFAS, which are man-made chemicals identified by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as contaminants of emerging concern. And they're looking at how those were used the academy until 2009 and thinking that they're likely the source of contamination at three wells servicing the Hyannis water system.
And as we heard Bill Evel saying from the Vineyard, this is kind of it's happening across the country. People are becoming aware of PFAS and the concerns around these. explain a little bit now what happens with the Barnstaple audit here and what they're expecting.
So ultimately, the goal is to reduce the amount of PFAS that are migrating in the groundwater towards the Mary Dunn public water supply wells. The DEP audit was conducted in response to growing concerns by town officials and citizens about the amount of water being used at the academy and whether it was carrying those contaminants toward the well field. The DEP ordered the county to complete 5 tasks by February 28th. Those include an evolution of expanding the groundwater recovery treatment system at the site, establishing a contract with a carbon replacement company that will ensure timely changes in a groundwater treatment system to avoid its going offline, and installing a more robust cap on an impervious layer over the most contaminated areas of the site, along with continuing to monitor that area.
And the county has been working on this effort for a little while now and has put some money toward it for a while now.
Yes, they have. They've actually requested $500,000 for academy cleanup from the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates, and that was approved by ordinance on Wednesday. The county has already spent nearly $7 million on cleanup at the academy since 2016.
And the levels of contaminants above, explain a little bit about the threshold and what it is the concern is really about PFAS, what it does that people have concerns about.
So there are the levels of contaminants above the EPA's health advisory threshold have actually already triggered 2 public health advisories since 2015. Those advisories warned pregnant women, nursing mothers, and infants against consuming water from the Hyannis water supply. However, it is they've sort of reassessed that, and the water supply in the Hyannis system is now considered safe to use and consume.
We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham, like many towns across the Cape, has been wrestling with issues of affordable housing and housing for young families. There's a new initiative happening now led by a coalition of citizens, and it's quite a proactive initiative. Tell us about this.
Sure. This is something pretty innovative that came to light this week. And sort of as background, if you recall, a year or so ago, a group of business people and private citizens stepped in to buy a key parcel of downtown land here in Chatham known as the Eldridge Garage. And they held on to it until the town could get their act together and vote to appropriate money to buy this land, which ended up being important as a key parking area in town, which, you know, parking is at a premium here. So this week, a similar group, actually including some of those same people, announced that they plan to use pretty much that same process to buy single-family homes that are suitable for year-round families, smaller homes, and make them available as affordable housing. Now, this group of housing advocates and private residents, they haven't come up with a formal name yet. They're sort of just being called a housing coalition. They've already purchased one home on Crowell Road here. They paid $355,000 for it. And what they're proposing is that the town's Affordable Housing Trust, which is an arm of the town, which gets funding from town meeting and the Community Preservation Fund, that group contribute an amount to reduce the cost of the home to about $200,000. So essentially buy down the final price of that house so that the mortgage would be affordable with a capital A to a local working family who would meet certain income guidelines. Now, this is, as I said, it was the model used for the Eldridge Garage property. The town has also followed a similar pattern in buying open space in the past, partnering with the Chatham Conservation Foundation. And the housing advocates say that they decided to act because they saw nothing really being done concretely to at least promote or to provide a little bit of affordable housing in town. They said that whenever a home that's under $500,000 comes on the market here, and that's pretty rare, actually. There aren't too many properties at that price point here in Chatham. They can snap it up quickly, more often than not, they can then hold it for the town to take those steps to set aside the money needed to buy down the mortgage and then work with the town to sell it to a qualified buyer. Otherwise, they say these lower price homes are getting snapped up by second homeowners, second home people, and often getting completely bulldozed so that something new and big and bright can be built. They don't expect that this is going to produce a lot of affordable housing, but it's going to at least be a concrete example of steps taken to put a dent in, you know, what, like you said, Steve, an escalating crisis here and throughout the Cape, really. Go ahead.
In the same vein, the planning board in Chatham is also promoting a bylaw, a change to the bylaw to encourage accessory dwelling units. And again, this is an effort to increase housing stock there.
Sure. This is going on in a number of Cape towns, and it's being promoted by the Cape Cod Commission and the housing and other housing groups to allow folks to add an accessory apartment to a single-family home, which would create not necessarily affordable housing, but at least create additional apartments. The apartment situation here, and I know in other Cape towns, is very tight. There's a very low occupancy rate or a very low turnover rate. So the planning board here in Chatham held two workshops last week on a draft accessory dwelling unit bylaw that they hope to put before town meeting in May, which would allow anyone with a single-family home to create a separate dwelling unit within the home, or if they have, if they get a special permit, they'd be able to build like a garage with an apartment above it, or something to that effect. There was some pushback from some folks who were concerned about density and other issues, and there was agreement from some planning board members that the language of the draft could be tightened up a little bit to prevent abuse. You know, clarify that only year-round occupied houses could qualify for this, and possibly limit the number, at least in the initial years, limit the number of permits they'd provide for this. But there was general support for this among people who turned out for these workshops. And the planning board's going to be tweaking the language a little bit and then revisiting a revised draft in the next couple weeks.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, students in Bourne are going to be taught skills for dealing with an active shooter situation. I guess it's one of those things that's hard to wrap your head around, but it seems like the times call for this.
Yes, so a school security forum was held at Bourne High School to inform parents that there'll be an active shooter training that students will take part in after the holidays. Bourne, if you can remember back in October, the middle school principal received a phone call saying that an active shooter was in the school. The threat was determined not to be credible, but school officials said that the experience felt real, you know, when you don't know if it's credible or not. They said they're not going to stop researching, reviewing, and adjusting their safety program. They're going to continue to try to find things that work. They're now taking the direction of implementing the ALICE program. ALICE stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, and Evacuate. The program doesn't set a sequence for the actions or the steps, and any individual might use part of the program or all five steps according to the situation. The research says that civilians have actually stopped active shooter events twice as often as police intervention, and that's sort of the reason they're going in the direction with ALICE. The old method of response told students to sit down and be quiet and hope that the next noise they heard at the door was a police officer, but under the ALICE program, they want students to do more. Some of the major changes include alerting people in the building with as much information as possible as to where the threat is. And if students go into lockdown and can't evacuate, they're now asked to barricade the entrance with objects in the classroom like desks or filing cabinets and chairs. And the biggest thing overall, though, is to really confront the intruder. Students and teachers are asked to gather objects in the room to throw at the intruder if a person enters, and to remember that there's strength in numbers. Police are saying, you know, police in Bourne suggested screaming, yelling, throwing things, and keep throwing things. And said that a person can't take the offensive when they're distracted. Another suggestion was to, if possible, get five people or one per appendage, sort of one for each arm and leg, to actually bring the intruder down and take away the weapon and secure it. As you mentioned, the idea of confrontation isn't really easy to think about, I think, especially mm-hmm. if you're a parent considering that you have a student at the school. but that the old strategy made sitting ducks. There are also other improvements besides just ALICE that have been made in the past few years to help ensure student safety, including making sure there's a single entry point at each school during the day and that making sure all hallway classroom doors are equipped with lockdown magnetic strips.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. On the phone with us right now is Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
Ed, a new proposal being looked at by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, could defund some local community access television stations. These are stations that might carry local government meetings and a whole lot more. You've got a nice article detailing what the implications could be for Provincetown and the Lower Cape. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is really an important story, really a national story, and not just a local story. The background here is that when the Cable Communications Act of 1984 was passed, it established the principle that cable companies like Comcast, Xfinity, and Verizon Fios have to pay franchise fees to local towns and cities for the right to have access to public rights of way and to their markets. And those fees are used to fund a local community access television stations. So, for example, we have Provincetown Community Television, or PTV, that serves Provincetown and Truro as well, and Lower Cape TV that serves the communities of Brewster, Orleans, Eastham, Wellfleet, and Truro. And they broadcast a wide variety of programs, including many meetings of local boards, regulatory boards, county commissions, etc., as well as other cultural programming. And the amount of money is substantial. What's happening is that the FCC has now proposed a new set of rules about these fees that would allow the cable companies to deduct the value of their in-kind services from those franchise fees that they pay to towns, including the value, supposedly, of the channels themselves, which was specifically not allowed in the original Cable Communications Act. And
tell us a little bit about what that impact could be for the Provincetown station or in the Lower Cape.
Well, for example, Teresa Martin, who's the executive director at Lower Cape TV, says that this is really a potential disaster. She says each town would be losing a big chunk of money with which they run channels and have cameras at town hall and audio systems in media rooms. Part of the deal is that the cable companies provide training so they established TV stations, say, at the local schools, like at Nauset Regional High School, and students and other local people can learn how to produce their own TV shows. This would really very likely just eliminate all those kinds of services. And this really has come in very quickly. The director of Provincetown TV says, "This all happened very quickly. It was unexpected. We haven't had a lot of response time. Indeed, there was a public response period for the FCC change that expired on November 14th. There is still an opportunity to comment until December 14th, but there's a really good article about this on the WGBH website by Dan Kennedy, who notes that we shouldn't expect very much from the FCC. The chair of the FCC, Ajit Pai, was successful recently, as many people know, in repealing net neutrality, and even though there was quite a big public outcry about that. But it's still worthwhile to contact local and state and federal legislators to express people's opinions on this. The point is that this is the main way that people can have access to their local government in many ways. Broadcasts of local selectmen's meetings, school committee, planning board, zoning board, etc. Newspapers depend on this as well. You know, at the Banner, we're down to one reporter, and we can't get to many of those meetings. We need to watch them on TV in order to see what's happening and be able to report on them. So if this rule goes through, that's going to really significantly impair local newspapers' ability to report the news as well.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
I'm Steve Junker. With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, it's deer hunting season, and one of the things that goes along with that is the lovely opportunity to count ticks on the deer that are brought in. There's an interesting story about tick counts this week from Cindy McCormick and some of the unusual results that are being seen.
Yes, I found this story fascinating. So entomologists from Plymouth and Barnstable counties who were assisting with research done by Stephen Rich, who is a microbiologist who runs the tick report at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, spent Monday at weigh station collecting ticks from deer carcasses brought in by hunters. And now, typically, an individual carcass could be host to dozens of crawling male and engorged female ticks, especially deer ticks. And usually there are so many that hunters say they have to be careful handling their kills. But interestingly, there was little sign of ticks at this most recent count. Of the two deer that Barnstable County entomologist Larry Dapsis searched at the weigh station at Goose Hummock in Orleans, one had 20 ticks and the other deer just had one. And Dapsis is saying there's something happening to the tick population that really they can't explain at this point. The findings were also really surprising in Middleborough, where an entomologist with the Plymouth County Extension Service found that only 11 of approximately 40 deer carcasses that were brought in were even worth sampling. He said the rest were really devoid of ticks. They're saying this situation is kind of atypical, not something that they've typically seen in the past. Tick-free deer have been found at each of the 12 sites where the scientists typically conduct sampling. But the scientists are also saying that people shouldn't use these results as a reason to let down their guard when it comes to tick prevention. Actually, the sampling, it's interesting, is being done partly to be used for surveillance because there's expected to be this inevitable arrival of the Asian longhorn tick coming in. So they're out there looking for that. But there seem to be some geographical patterns emerging to this, with a lot of the tick-laden deer coming from Middleborough and tick-free deer coming from places like Carver, which is interesting because Carver is usually considered to have a large population of ticks. Entomologists participating as well found that in Norwell, which has some of Plymouth County's highest rates of Lyme disease, they didn't find anything in the course of 3 hours while they were out there searching for ticks. And in the same locations in May and June, 100 ticks were collected in half an hour.
What are some guesses of why this disparity in how many ticks they're seeing could be happening?
So some researchers think that the hot, dry spell earlier this summer may have killed off some of the moisture-loving ticks, and others are wondering if maybe more recent wet weather in the fall led to some kind of fungal development that may have killed them. But they'll be back out there this Saturday sampling more deer carcasses for ticks.
Toy drives around the region are finding themselves challenged to keep up with demand this holiday season. It's interesting that this need doesn't represent just something frivolous, but it's about families having enough to accommodate basic needs.
Yes, our reporter Cindy McCormick talked to several different nonprofits across the Cape. She said the Family Pantry of Cape Cod and Harwich is still getting calls for assistance, although it's already registered 1,000 children for the toy drive. Major Cynthia Brown of the Hyannis Salvation Army said that calls for assistance are up from last year. But as you mentioned, this isn't just about toys. A lot of the nonprofits said that more Cape residents are using, just as they're using food pantries to help feed their families, they're increasingly turning to toy drives to avoid straining their already tight budgets even further at Christmas time. The director of the Family Pantry of Cape Cod said that the need is huge. The pantry's Christmas toy drive, which provides toys and games for children and families has just about tripled in size over the past 5 years. I guess last year it served about 1,100 children. This year they had to cap it at about 1,000 because it was really getting too big for them to manage. This year the number of people served by the pantry with food and clothing also climbed to about 9,500, and that's a 12% increase over 2017. The reasons behind this are really sort of a combination of high costs of housing and daycare combined with low seasonal employment in the winter, and that leaves families cash-strapped at Christmas. And that's according to a case manager with the Homelessness Prevention Council in Orleans. And she said there's really a crisis. There's no housing down here, there's no rentals, and that with such a limited supply, rentals on the housing market can go for as high as $2,500 a month for a three-bedroom home.
You can understand why a family faced with that would have challenges through the winter here.
Yes. And so there's, you know, still this effort to get some of these toys in place. The Marines Toys for Tots program, that which goes on every year, is actually currently holding its Stuff a Bus drive through the end of the weekend. And even that's a little more challenging because the place where it usually holds it at Toys R Us has since closed. And they're having to shift their locations. They're holding it at the Kmart in Hyannis and the Walmart in Falmouth. That'll be going on through Sunday afternoon.
Let's talk about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. They have an international backer in its effort to build a casino in Taunton. It seems like the tribe's recent difficulties over its federal status are impacting that backer as well.
Yes, so Genting Malaysia Berhad, which, as you mentioned, is the tribe's financial backer, announced Friday that it suffered an impairment loss of about $440 million during the third quarter year, and that was related to its investment in promissory notes that were issued by the tribe. Now, an impairment loss occurs when the company sells or abandons an asset that it deems no longer beneficial. That must then be reflected as a loss on its financial statements. And this impairment loss was actually due to the uncertainty of recovering those promissory notes following a government's decision that concluded that the tribe's land can't be held in trust. The December 7th decision came through from the Department of the Interior, and it overturned an Obama-era determination declaring the tribe's eligibility to have its 321 acres of land taken into trust under a 1934 federal statute. The Department of the Interior sided with the federal court finding in September, stating that the Secretary of the Interior did not have the authority to take the land into trust because the tribe was not under federal jurisdiction at the time of the passage of the Indian Reorganization Act in 1934, and therefore didn't qualify under the definition of Indian used by the Department of Interior officials.
What does this mean now for the tribe? It means that they get less, they've been getting less money, less support from their backer?
Yeah, so Genting has said that it's going to continue working with the tribe by supporting legislation introduced earlier this year. But as you mentioned, the contributions to the tribe seem to have gone down. In May, the tribal council approved a budget that saw significantly fewer loan dollars from Genting than in previous years. It actually received $5.4 million this fiscal year in loans from Genting, and that's less than half of what it received for fiscal 2017. But Genting is ramping up spending on lobbying this year in an effort to influence the Department of the Interior. And it says that, you know, if this decision comes through and these lands are taken into trust, it could possibly reverse some of those losses.
Let's talk about the sea turtles. It's been a busy time of year for the people and many of them volunteers who look for and help rehabilitate sea turtles. Your reporter, Doug Frazier, took a look at this week.
Yeah, so at the last count, there were actually 712 tropical sea turtles that were retrieved from Cape Cod Bay beaches since October.
712
since
October.
That's a lot,
yes.
Yeah. And what happens is in the cold weather, their metabolism gets slowed down to the point that they're immobilized and they sort of drift at the will of the wind. Mortality this year, though, has been particularly high, with nearly 300 of the turtles dead. A wintry temperature dip around Thanksgiving actually resulted in some of the smaller turtles being frozen solid. As you can imagine, that can be kind of demoralizing for the people who are trying to rescue them, but it seems like there has been this bright spot for them. There is a turtle that they found. A large loggerhead turtle came ashore on Great Island in Wellfleet. feet the day
Very
before
large.
Thanksgiving. It was really large, 301 pounds. It's a female, and she appears to be making a strong recovery. Only about these loggerheads, she's a female loggerhead turtle, and they're listed as threatened with extinction by the Federal Endangered Species List. And although they inhabit a lot of the world's oceans, their numbers have been depleted sort of by the typical things, hunting, climate change, habitat destruction. And typically, these places at the aquarium that help to rehabilitate these turtles are dealing with smaller, younger, juvenile turtles. This one, however, is a 5-foot-long female loggerhead, and she's estimated to be between 30 and 50 years old based on her size. And they said this may be the largest turtle they've ever rehabbed. She's doing well. It seemed lively at the time. She still has some issues to work through. She had an amputated right flipper in the front and also in the back, but they expect that as she continues to recover, she'll gain even more weight, estimated to gain 50 pounds in the months ahead.
It's been interesting that Cape Garden centers have been having some difficulty getting enough Christmas greens. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, so this was interesting too. Supposedly this year, a freak frost that struck in June and a deep chill in Canada, recent deep chill in Canada, where fir trees are used to source these wreaths, have made it tough for garden centers on the Cape to get the greens they need to supply their customers. And it's particularly been affecting the brush that makes holiday arrangements, such as wreaths. Our reporter spoke with Mahoney's Garden Centers, and it has its own plantation in Nova Scotia that helps stock its 7 stores in Massachusetts. But the demand is so high that the company orders from other Canadian vendors as well. They said they usually order about 5,000 wreaths, but vendors are running short, so they're only getting about half of what they would usually buy this year.
What were some of the reasons for this shortage? Tell us.
Well, so the owner of that garden facility said that typically they get balsam or white pines, but this year the tips that they cut for the wreaths are all so buried underneath the snow that oftentimes the people who are going to get them can't actually get to the tree to cut the tips. Another, James DeLong, who's the owner of a farm in Nova Scotia that cultivates about 1,000 acres of Christmas trees, said that there are really two factors that affected this year. Again, there was that severe frost in June. He said it took about 60% of their trees and 80% of the brush. And since early November, Nova Scotia has been buried in snow and temperatures are dipping to record lows. And again, that makes it hard for them to get out there and harvest these things that they need to make these wreaths and send them down here to these Cape Garden centers.
And it was not only weather. In the end, also where these greens are being harvested and produced, a shift in the labor that's happening up there.
Yes. So there is also a labor shortage. And that was according to John Duffley, who's the manager of Hyannis Country Garden. He said that there used to be that there was a lot of labor available to make the wreaths, but that labor force is getting older and that the younger generation just really isn't interested in wreath making. Duffley usually orders 1,800 wreaths, said that they usually arrive in 2 deliveries, and that this year they've kind of had to piece things together. He said the smaller numbers are arriving via multiple deliveries and things were really off to a bad start and it's not getting any better.
Many people this week watching the remembrances and funeral for President Bush. As you might imagine, he had some Cape connections. He came to Mashpee as president in 1990. Tell us about this.
Yes, so our reporter spoke with several Cape residents who recalled the morning of November 1st, 1990, when George H.W. Bush made a stop in Mashpee during a political tour through Massachusetts. At the time, he was campaigning for William Weld for governor and for John Rappaport for the U.S. Senate. And we spoke with Ernest Virgilio, who was involved with the Mashpee Republican Town Committee and helped organize the visit at the time. And he said it was just fantastic. He said it was a wonderful event and that a lot of people worked very, very hard to make it happen. He said he got the call that Bush would be in the area and would like to visit Mashpee. And then he had to go through and get approval from the Board of Selectmen and met with presidential staff and security to find a site that would be the best fit for the visit and the most secure. And met with actually the advance team at Otis Air National Guard Base. And they went through the town and eventually settled on a location. They chose Mashpee Middle School. He said it was pretty amazing and it worked out. Everyone had a spectacular time. During the rally at the school, Bush told the audience, he said, "Let me say how great it is to be back back on the Cape to breathe the deep magic of this place. And he quoted Henry David Thoreau and said, a man may stand here and put all America behind him. And local politicians and residents came from across the Cape to greet him. He listened to several presentations with members of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. And, you know, all around, people just said that this was a visit to remember.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you to Sarah Mises-Tan, WCAI's lead reporter, Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.